Good evening, James McKinney here with my Science Hour, December 11th, 2014. And I last week, first of all, it took me a while to get the show posted. Sorry about that. Sometimes things happen. But anyway, eventually it was posted, I think, on Tuesday. So I apologize for that. I'll try to be more punctual. But also, at the beginning of the show, I talked about the date. I just said the date, 2017, and I'm not sure where that came from. But we are in 2014 as last reckoning. So, oops, live radio. Those are the kind of things that can happen. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about Earth's early atmosphere, the Great Flood, other issues. It was a question sent in by a listener, and so it's a topic that actually has been covered in my books. Some of my earliest work talks about the atmosphere prior to the great Earth disasters of what you might call, we call them prehistory, but in terms of the world, it's pretty modern history. There were two major events. The Great Flood was one of them, and on my two CD set, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters, I talk about the Great Flood, and that's the Noah event. And then I talk also, an event that happened many thousands of years later was the Moses event at the height of the bondage of the Israelites in Egypt, and of course they left Egypt under the tutelage of Moses, who was really an Israelite who grew up as in the Egyptian royalty. But all of that story, of course, there's a new movie out. I have not seen it yet. I want to go see it, dealing with those events. So just see if Hollywood has put one of those Hollywood twists on it, and I can only imagine that it has. But anyway, tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about the early Earth's atmosphere. And so some people asked me to promote some people who've done work in this field, and until I really examine who they are, where they've come from, etc., I don't do any promotion of other people here. Just because of that reason, my guess is that I was working on this and had this publicized probably decades before these people ever imagined such a thing, and also that possibly I was working on this before some of these people were even born. So at any rate, but let me make a few first announcements here. The uncanny rise in the U.S. dollar in recent weeks relative to certain foreign currencies. Now, this is very strange, and nobody that I've heard of, they talk about, oh, this is related to oil, the drop in the oil prices, and you know, I mean, nothing here makes any sense unless you understand that the bankers are trying to, the best explanation I've heard is that the bankers are trying to drive down the price of oil based on the U.S. dollar because Putin is giving them a run for their money, selling his oil on the world market outside the dollar market. And what they're trying to do is eliminate the possibility that Putin can sell Russian oil and affect the world market. So they're driving up artificially the price of the dollar, which shows that they can do this on a moment's notice. But what's happening in third world countries is the currency exchange rate is going bonkers, which will affect the third world countries. The poorest people will be most drastically affected because things like rice, which are imported for basic food, the cost of that will go up. People will starve to death because of this little political game that's going on up in the upper ranks of bankers and oil and other world chess games that are going on. But also this could be a prelude to the crash of the U.S. dollar. So isn't it funny how greed works? They were getting ready to crash the dollar. Putin and China buy up tremendous amounts of gold and start dealing in all kinds of commodities, including oil, outside of the dollar. So they have to come back and prop up the dollar, counter to what they want to do, so that they can try and undercut the people who are hedging against the dollar. They're really, Putin is not hedging against the dollar. He's simply preparing his country for the fall of the dollar, something that everybody knows is coming. But in because he did that, the bankers have to go to prop up the dollar. It's so funny. Greed has so many modes. It's just funny to watch. Just a quick comment. There's a lot of news today about racism in the United States. Athletes are becoming involved, etc. But remember that racism is one of the coins that is being used to control the public. And I'm not saying there isn't racism. There's racism in all directions. Being a white male Christian from Ireland origins, when I was at Cornell, it wasn't like I exactly fit in with the genre of professors that were there. So there was a lot of you could just run it right back to racism against me at Cornell. So racism has many directions, many faces, but in its current form, it's something that can be used to divide the public, to pit one group against the other, and also to cloud the issues, the real issues that are going on in the world today. It's a tool. It's a tool that has been used effectively prior to many world wars. Racism became an issue. So that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying there isn't racism. I'm just saying that it is a tool that can be used by people in power to gain control and to get the public, one group fighting the other, and that's how they maintain control, is when they can maintain this group here fighting that group, and all of these little wars going on, and everybody loses sight of what the real issue is here, and that is that the world bankers are running the show, including the world governments. So, at any rate, the 9/11 witch hunt fear that happened right after 9/11 back in 2001, the CIA began to just take people off the street, and at the head of this were the Arabs that they captured from around the world, took them as detainees to a place called Guantanamo in Cuba, and tortured them. Now the stories of torture are coming out, and this was all sanctioned by the Bush administration. It was well known that the torture was going on back then, but Bush said, well, we got to do it. We got to do it to protect this country, and his solemn oath to the American public was to protect us. And we're all finding out a decade later that it was all a ruse. But the CIA was in there torturing people. And why it took this long to come to the surface is, that's because it was done under the watchful eye of the bankers. Now, the whole issue of 9/11 to gain control of the United States, and how many times have you ever seen Congress vote 100-0 on anything? How absurd was happening regularly after 9/11, including all the procurement money for the military, etc. So at any rate, it is no surprise that eventually the CIA torture issue would come out and come to roost. But my point here is that you have to understand who these people are. The CIA is not some agency with your best interest in mind protecting the rights of American citizens. They're the Nazis who moved to the United States after World War II. That's who started the CIA. The Bill Donovans and the other people who were instrumental, the Bushes were involved in that, in forming the CIA. But they were basically the Nazi spy, the SS from Nazi Germany that came into the United States. Just like they brought the scientists here, just like they brought other groups of people out of Nazi Germany, including the banks, All of that moved into the United States after World War II. That's where the CIA came from. They have never, ever been something American and good. They have been the most evil, corrupt group. They were the people who occupied Cuba when Castro threw them out, along with the mob. That's where they did their dirty work, was out of Cuba. So the Cuban Revolution was about throwing out the bank police force, the CIA, and the mobsters, basically who were one and the same working together. Not one and the same, but they were working together. So at any rate, is it any surprise that they are now the biggest drug trafficking organization in the world? When Iran-Contra was going on, the CIA was involved in that, at the very core of all of that. So when it came 9-1-1, they just came to the forefront in all their glory and started torturing people. That's a long, complex story, but at any rate, whether anything will really happen to the people that were behind that, all the way up to the Bushes. The old man was the head of the CIA, then he was vice president under Reagan, and then he went back clandestine and started running operations out of Canada to control the water in the Western Hemisphere. You have to understand who these people are. And that brings me to my next point, is that the American public are the most stupid people on the planet, and that's one of the big problems in the world today, is that men and women in the United States are so stupid about what's going on in the world. And of course, it's all attributable, not all, but 99% attributable to the news media owned by the bankers, the school systems being operated now with Common Core, etc., where the students are being rubber stamped out mentally. What a disaster, guaranteeing that they can manipulate these people far into the future. By the way, as a mathematician, someone who has taught mathematics and been many, many levels, all the way from, I've taught in high school, that was my very first job out of college. When I went to Mexico, I taught in a college or in a high school, and I taught the kids of the very rich people. That's what I was doing, and I tutored them individually. I was in the most exclusive houses in Mexico City, tutoring the children of the very wealthy people. And believe me, Mexico City has some of the most wealthy people on the planet that aren't even noted in the Forbes 500 or whatever. But at any rate, my point is that the American public really has no clue of what is going on in the world, who is running it. But just a comment on Common Core mathematics. My point was, in talking about who I've taught in mathematics, I've taught at the university level. If you look at my bio, you will find that I have taught probably every course that there is at the undergraduate level at the university level, all the way up to math analysis, statistics, calculus, all levels, engineering calculus, abstract algebra, matrix algebra, logic. I've taught it all at the university level. And so I'm very familiar. I conquered one of the most complex, challenging problems of all of mathematics from the beginning of history, the direct calculation of the prime numbers, and I put it to practical use. My book, which is Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, I worked in encryption and in secure computing for 10 years of my life as an engineer at a high-level telecommunications corporation building IBM-compatible telecommunications computers. So at any rate, I have a bit of background in mathematics. My comment about Common Core is that when students get out of high school, the bridge to higher mathematics will be totally lost. This is an absolute disaster. We are going to have generations of kids who have no ability to go into higher math. And You have this being designed by people who have never been in higher math. So how can they design a mathematics course that will bridge them into the future if they don't know the future, if they've never been more than a college level? You have to understand that most people in the administration of schools today have very weak educations. They went into the philosophy of teaching or something like that, but they don't have background in the core courses that they pretend to administer. So at any rate, I want to talk to parents a little bit about Common Core. You have to get your kids, if they're going to understand mathematics at a higher level, and this is an absolute disaster for the USA in the future, when the universities look for students to come in and go into mathematics or physics or engineering or astrophysics or any of the other, into medicine, into chemistry, anything that requires advanced mathematics, they are going to be absolutely lost because their base simply will not be there. This is an absolute disaster. So just a quick comment. I don't know what I can do about this other than inform people. But, okay, on to the next topic, the Rosetta mission. Now, the news reporting on the Rosetta mission has been faulty at best for a long time. All you can say is that it has been twisted and covered. Now, this article actually appeared in late November, but I'm just getting into it right now on this show. The name of the article, it was posted in Space. Now, that's an internet site. It's a popular internet site. It's a mouthpiece for NASA, as many of these are, like Discover Magazine or National Geographic or the History Channel. NASA kind of has free rein, and the editors who post these articles are just mouthpieces. In general, they are not good scientists. They have very weak scientific background. All they can do is take the information they have been given by NASA, regurgitate it in some form. So I want to read this article and show you how the news is twisted. Okay, the name of this article, it's called Elements of Life in Space. Rosetta Probe Discovers Organic Molecules on Comet. Now, just examining this title, it says Elements of Life in Space. Okay, so we're talking about organic molecules, obviously. Not cells, not animals, not little live things, but we're talking about organic molecules, etc. But anyway, then the second part, it says, this is the twisted part. It says the Rosetta probe, which of course is the probe that landed on a comet nucleus, back a number of months ago, says the Rosetta probe, now this is the one that lands on the nucleus. Now there's the mother craft which orbits the comet nucleus, and then there's the Rosetta probe called Philae. And so anyway, it says the Rosetta probe, this is the one that lands on the nucleus, says discovers organic molecules on comet. So that would imply, by reading that title, that the lander was able to detect organic molecules, the basis of life, on the comet nucleus. Now let's read the article and see what really happened here. It says, I'm reading from the article. I want to read this word for word so that you, it's not going to be interpreted by me or the words change. I want to read this word for word, and then we'll talk about what it really is saying. It says, as if the Rosetta Comet Probe mission wasn't cool enough already, the team behind Rosetta mission says that they've discovered organic compounds in the comet's atmosphere. Whoa, wait a minute. The atmosphere is up above the nucleus, not on the nucleus. So right there in the first sentence, they contradict the title. The probe was looking up into the atmosphere, that cloud that surrounds the comet, not the comet nucleus. Okay, and this is hugely important. it goes on to say, the discovery could give scientists new insight into the origins of life on Earth. And, of course, that's the broad paintbrush that they always try and give to everything. Like, we're going to learn all about where our DNA came from or whatever, where the chicken and egg came from. Then it goes on to say, a report in the Wall Street Journal said that the German agency behind the Rosetta mission was currently analyzing the findings of the Rosetta probe's analytic data of the comet's atmosphere. There again, it's talking about atmosphere, not the nucleus, understand. It says the initial findings, though, indicated that the Philae lander had, in fact, detected organic compounds within the comet's atmosphere. Okay, once again, atmosphere. That's not the nucleus. By the title, when they say discovered organic molecules on the comet, that's very deceptive because the atmosphere is not on the nucleus. Now, the implication, of course, is by the dirty snowball comet model, which is their little baby, it would imply that that atmosphere came off the nucleus and therefore was from the nucleus. But here's the problem. I'll read the rest of this article. When they go to sample the material on the body of the comet using a drill, they don't talk about it. Now, if they discovered organic molecules on the comet nucleus, they'd be jumping up and down and screaming to high heaven, but they don't say that. It's like in the third paragraph, kind of hidden. So the point is, if there's organic molecules in the atmosphere, wouldn't you expect them to find them, the organic molecules, on the comet nucleus where they're supposedly coming from? But they don't. Okay, I'll read here again. I'll continue reading. I'm going to read this article quickly, and we'll go back and talk about it. It says, The organic compounds are the very building blocks of life on Earth. The term encompasses compounds containing the carbon atom, and it includes combinations of as simple as methane and methanol and as complex as the amino acids that make up proteins. The Rosetta team is currently analyzing the probe's findings in order to determine the complexity of the organic compounds detected. And I just want to explain this a little bit. When you use a spectrometer to determine chemicals, what you're seeing is some characteristic lines from carbon, some smaller molecules like methane or other smaller molecules that build up the bigger molecules. But it's very difficult to determine big molecules by spectroscopy. It's one of the more difficult things in all of chemistry. So they're trying to examine to see if there's some telltale sign of bigger molecules, and that's normal. But the point is, they're examining data from the atmosphere of the comet, not the comet nucleus. Okay, now here we're down in the fourth paragraph, and it says, in addition to the probe's atmospheric sampling, the Philae probe also grabbed material from the samples from the comet's body using a drill. Okay, now they're talking about the body of the comet. It says the data from that experiment has not been fully analyzed yet. Well, gee, if they could quick get all that data from the atmosphere, analyze it, and talk about it, then how come not the body? They got the data, they got the material dug, but wouldn't you expect to find one thing there, especially water? If they had drilled and found water, even the most faint drop, molecule of water, they would be announcing it to high heaven. But they don't say a word about it. Because you know why? There isn't any. There are no organic molecules on the nucleus, and there is no water on the nucleus. Well, how could it be abundant in the tail, which is observed from a distance, if there's none on the nucleus? Where is it coming from? Where exactly is that tail material coming from? And of course, the answer is it's not coming from the nucleus. It's being drawn into the nucleus. My plasma discharge comet model explains this, but they don't talk about it. They're sitting there with their finger up their nose because they can't explain it. But they still have to put these gee whiz articles out there to make it sound like they're discovering the origins of life to give them next year's funding. Okay, it says here, it goes on the next paragraph, The team isn't totally surprised by the findings. It had, in fact, expected that organic molecules would be found on the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. The Rosetta mission, though, did provide the first opportunity to search directly for organic materials on and around the comet. See, on and around the comet. But they're only talking about the results from around the comet. The materials on the comet, they're quiet as a church mouse. See, now it's important to analyze these articles because, then it goes on to say, the discovery of something like an amino acid on the surface of a comet would lend credence to the notions that life on Earth has extraterrestrial origins. One proposal for the origin of Earth's life posits that comets collided with Earth, seeding the planet with the materials necessary for life. Well, wait a minute, Batman and Robin. The Earth already has all the materials necessary for life. It has carbon, it has nitrogen, hydrogen, and oxygen, and when those combine, one of the natural compounds that is formed are the amino acids and the nucleides, which form the amino acids, which are the basis of DNA. So why do we have to look at some extraterrestrial source? What's that all about? And if they formed in some other place, how did they form there? they don't have answers to any of these basic questions at all. On my webpage, I have a, if you go down on the homepage, scroll down, and I talk about the deep impact, all the lies and misinformation that came out of that NASA fiasco, which was, in a sense, successful. It proved that there is no water on a comet nucleus because they got right down to it. They were able to blast a hole in the nucleus of a comet, came out, and as I predicted, there was a big bright flash as the lander approached the nucleus. That was an electrical discharge between the lander, or the probe that they crashed into the comet nucleus, and the nucleus itself. And so, at any rate, a very important result, but totally twisted in the news media. I just want to recount one other issue, that the way they twisted the news there. They said that the lander in the probe, the deep impact probe, discovered water on the nucleus of a comet. But then when you read the fine print, it was an Earth-based telescope that saw a brightening, and actually the brightening of the comet, which implied water production on the nucleus by second and third hand logic, if you assume the dirty snowball comet model, that actual brightening happened before, like 2 days before the probe ever hit the comet. But you see how the news, they twist it in any way possible to maintain that. It's very important. And for new listeners, why is it important for science to lie to the public about theoretical work? Well, one is because they would have egg all over their face from decades and decades of telling people that comets are dirty snowballs. That's one issue. But the other is that if people found out that comets are electrical in nature, the discharge of the solar capacitor, and the Earth is doing this all the time, like all the other planets, that we have vast amounts of electricity flowing around the planet every day, the first question that would come to anybody's mind is, hey, can't we grab on to some of this electricity to run our society? We'd get rid of oil, nuclear, and coal as the main forces that drive our energy needs, and use electricity from outer space? And the answer is yes. That's what most of my work is about, is how to utilize science for the benefit of society and get rid of the bankers who control water, now control oil, now control water, and the economy and all of this craziness that's going on in the world, the wars, the chaos, the racism, the use of racism to control the news media, etc. All of this being just another way to control the public. And let me get back to my point that I started originally here a little while ago, was that men and women in the United States are just rock stupid. And if people steal from you repeatedly, like robbing all of your houses and giving it to the few people, the few rich people, then if they come back and rob you again, well, the first time, shame on them, and the second time, shame on you. the American public keeps letting these people control and manipulate and steal and turn everybody into slaves, basically, don't toss them out. So at any rate, the part of the big problem in the United States and in the world is the fact that the United States public is so stupid. And here's a suggestion to women. Women have to talk to other women. If I were to, say, jump on the League of Women's Voters, a bunch of very well-intentioned ladies running around trying to get everybody to vote, but they don't care who you vote for, just vote. Well, you know, that's some great intentions, but the reality is we live in a broken system, and if you vote, you're actually complementing that broken system simply by attributing your consent to the broken system, that somehow electing officials will somehow cure our problems. And no, it's a broken system. Both parties are controlled by the same group of bankers, and so women have to go out there and educate other women as to the fallacy of their ways. If I do it on this show, then I would be attacked for somehow being anti-women or anti-feminist or who knows what all I would be accused of. So at any rate, I'm just encouraging women who know what's going on, who have seen the light. And by the way, don't be surprised that you'll be shunned and turned away by people, because the most difficult thing in the world to do is to change somebody's mind who thinks they're doing good. Oh, it's just, yeah, or they think that they've been educated and they know how the political system works. They go to their political meetings and they're all the smartest people on the planet. And what do you know? How are you going to change them? Okay, so at any rate, let me just talk about a couple other quick news items here. This past week, they're talking about on Mars, a lake bed that they've discovered, but of course with the NASA twist that it's millions and millions of years old. You know, to draw that age out of a hat like a rabbit. But where do they get this millions of years old? Well, they have to say that because if they said the truth that the lake bed was recent, then, you know, how did Mars lose its atmosphere recently? You know, what process was there to all of a sudden Mars has this atmosphere, it has water just like Earth, lakes, rivers, oceans, and all of a sudden it's gone. Voila. Well, the answer is that it happened when Venus the comet came through the solar system. The ancients report this. And, you know, by the way, Mars, when the comet sighting spring came by just about a month ago, Mars atmosphere grew tremendously at that time, and that's something I said would happen. That's one of the side effects of having an interaction with the comet, is that Mars became a comet for a short period of time and gained atmosphere. We know from other space probes that Mars has been gaining atmosphere all along. Earth is gaining atmosphere constantly, and that brings me up to the actual topic of tonight's show. This came in through a listener email, and it's a topic that I covered back in my early work, that obviously the Earth's atmosphere, for many, many, many points of view, the Earth's atmosphere had to be much denser and a very different composition a long time ago. The human being was, a lot of people live in the northern climate. That's not the condition that the human body evolved in. The human body evolved in a climate with a lot of moisture. People are constantly putting creams. One of the biggest selling items in the northern hemisphere is creams to put on your hands and your face when it's cold outside and it's dry in the house. Or for all of the respiratory problems that people have because they're enclosed in a building for 6 months out of the year during winter, or in a car with the heat on and it's dry and you go from hot to cold. That's not the environment that the human body came from. It came from an environment where there was a lot of moisture in the air. There was, it probably did not rain. Remember, they didn't know about the rainbow after the Noah's flood. They said God put the rainbow in the sky to say when the rain would end. they didn't have rain previously. They didn't have rainbows. It was like a greenhouse where the plants just grew. One time when I was down in Tulane in New Orleans, beautiful climate. I had greenhouses in my house, and I'd take these big glass water bottles. That's when the water bottles, the 5-gallon water bottles, were made out of glass. And I'd make a little terrarium in there. You'd buy it at the plant store, these little teeny plants. And they grew, and for, you know, 6 to 12 months, they would just grow very slowly. And at the very bottom was carbon. Above that was gravel. Above that was a layer of kind of mesh. And then above that was regular dirt. And then you just planted your plants in there. And then the very last thing was that you poured water down around the outside of you poured water into the jar, into the glass jug, and that cleaned the sides, and that water then came down in the base, and that water constantly evaporated and filled there, and those plants just loved it. But it never rained, you never added water, you never watered the plants, and they were just lovely. And I'd set it not in direct sunlight, but in kind of a modest light where light would come in the window, and those plants just, they just thrived in there. It was just amazing. But that's what the world was like. The world had some people call it a canopy of water, but it was kind of a modest cloud cover. And so all the way from the poles, now we find that, for example, the Earth probably had climates like this many times throughout its history, and the Earth was then stripped of an atmosphere like this only to regain it with time. So they talk about the greenhouse effect being a bad thing. In this case, the greenhouse gave the Earth a very uniform temperature throughout, from the equator to the North Pole. This had to be the conditions also back in the dinosaur days, you know, millions, 100 million years ago, when the dinosaurs thrived and the plant life was just thick, you know, the Jurassic Park type of thing where you had lush tropical vegetation and just abundant vegetation, and whammo, in one day the Earth changed. Now when you see dinosaur bones, they're out in the Montana desert or up in Idaho or someplace, you know, buried in a rock under just hardened rock. And so those animals died very quickly. They didn't live there for long under those conditions because there was nothing to eat. Can you imagine, you know, a buffalo eats, I can't remember how much a buffalo eats. What do you think a woolly mammoth ate per day? We're talking some serious grub here. And now imagine what a dinosaurus, you know, one of those giant wading around in a swamp. Can you imagine the amount of vegetation that one of those animals ate in a day? Just incredible, incredible amounts of vegetation. So the Earth had to be producing this, and you don't just have one or two of them. You had vast herds of these, millions of them, all over the Earth. So the Earth had to be very different than it is today. The Earth today, even in the most dense jungles, couldn't support even one dinosaur because of the necessity of vegetation, the amount of vegetation that these things ate. So it had to be just constant. And so when the human beings came along, they grew up, they evolved in an atmosphere like this. And then all of a sudden things changed. So what happened? Well, you had the Great Flood was one of the events. And remember, though, that the Great Flood was just rain. It was just torrential rains for 40 days and 40 nights. But that was way after the dinosaurs had already died off. That was another event far deeper in history. The idea that an asteroid collided with Earth and caused the demise of the dinosaurs has pretty much been liquidated. Something else happened, and that something else was the passage of a large comet. Very clearly, all of the effects, and you find that the people, that the scientists who want to maintain the concept that Earth jumped up and did all this by itself, many things happened at the same time that are not accountable to an Earth that just jumps up and does this by itself all of a sudden, nor is it attributable to the single impact of an asteroid, which has been far over-exaggerated by NASA and their computer modeling. Let me jump up to the Moses event. This is when the Venus, the comet, came by. This is something we actually have record of. The NOAA event, remember, that we passed through. Now, this is once again, I have a two CD set. It's called The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. 18 hours of lectures on two CD sets in MP3 format. But two of the chapters deal, one of them with the NOAA event, the Great Flood, the other one, which was thousands of years later, the Moses event or the Venus event, and that's the one Velikovsky talks about, and that's the one we actually have identified the comet because it eventually became the planet Venus. How does a comet become a planet? That's what is explained in my work. And once again, that's why the standard science community has to go back to this little dirty snowball concept of the Rosetta mission or the Siding Spring. And they keep repeating this, you know, garbage that couldn't ever possibly be true, because all of the history of man would change. All of the concepts that are in textbooks would change. I just find it surprising when I see these NASA scientists at a meeting, American Geophysical Union meeting, or the other like on the internet, and they're describing this and they're going through this fairy tale science of how the water on comets gave life to Earth and on and on. What they're doing is just repeating like a nursery rhyme, and that's all it is. There's nothing in the scientific data that they, when they go out to visit comets, there's nothing that has been verified regarding a dirty snowball comet model. They've never discovered any ice or water or snow on a comet nucleus, and they certainly never discovered any coming off of the nucleus, including the current Rosetta mission. The material in the tail is coming in towards the comet nucleus. And so anyway, I'm not going to go into more detail on that, but okay, back to the concept of Earth's atmosphere. Now, the whole concept that, for example, the mastodons, this is something that Velikovsky discovered and made more public. He didn't discover it, but he made note of the fact that when the Siberian railways, for example, were being built across Siberia, so this is back in the early 1900s when they're trying to develop Russia and to put a land bridge out into Siberia. They're cutting through the tundra ice to lay the railroad tracks, and lo and behold, they are coming across these frozen mastodons. Standing up on all fours, they start to realize that, hey, this meat is fresh. They start to eat it. You're out on the Siberian railway. Hey, buddy, there's not a lot to eat out there, and I'm sure that wasn't like the best supply train going out there to feed these guys. They start eating the meat from the mastodons. It becomes so common and so plentiful that they start shipping it off to France for delicacies. Now, the people in France, I would probably cater to say, no putrid meat when they see it. So this meat coming in from Siberia, from mastodons, that are thousands and thousands of years old, don't you think that if it were rotten, the French probably would not have put it on the menu as a delicacy? So at any rate, these animals were flash frozen so quickly that their meat was preserved for thousands of years. You know the thing called freezer burn. If you put, especially in the old-fashioned freezers, if you put something in the ice box and you don't have it sealed well, it's completely sealed with plastic or some kind of airtight container, then it's going to dry out. And that's what you call freezer burn. It actually dries out the meat and it burns it, and it makes the meat unpalatable. You can't eat it. But the mastodon meat was preserved there exactly, 100% exactly like the day it died. Now, I talked about this on my show many times. I went to a buffalo farm, a ranch where they raise buffalo. And I thought, I'm going to go talk to the main guy, the butcher shop, because there they actually butchered the bison, the buffaloes, and they sold the meat, etc. So I went in, and they had, you know, it was right at the ranch, outside the door in the back 40 are the buffalo roaming around. And so, I think it was in the winter, it was like a cold winter day. And I went talk to the guy, the butcher, and I said, if you took a whole buffalo and you put them in your freezer, I said, how long would it take to freeze that buffalo? And of course, what they do is they cut it into pieces and then they freeze it, and that freezes normally. But I said, if you took a whole buffalo, put it in the freezer, how long would it take to freeze? And he's like, you know, it wouldn't work. I mean, it would be going bad before the part on the inside of the meat got frozen. It would just take way too long. And I said, well, what if the animal was alive? And he looked at me like, you're crazy. A live buffalo, you put him in the freezer, he'd just stand there. He's not going to die. He's not going to freeze. He's going to stand there. He's got a thick coat, and you take him down to 40 below, he's going to stand there and look at you. You can't kill a buffalo, and this go up to the bigger the animal, the more heat content they have in their body, and the more volume they have relative to the surface area, so the harder it would be to kill them. And by the way, the mastodons were there on all 4 feet. They're standing there. They're not. They didn't fall over and die. They were standing on all 4 feet. So they were flash frozen instantaneously by a cold that was so incredibly cold and severe that the animals died with the undigested flowering plants, very delicate flower, that would have been changed into kind of a goo in a matter of maybe half a minute, in their throats, undigested. Because the digestion in an animal like that begins in their throat with the acids, etc., in the digestive tract in the throat. Already has begun to dissolve the plant material before it goes into the stomach. And so these animals died with flowers still fresh in their throats. That's how fast they were flash frozen. An animal that big, now how do you do this? I mean, this is some serious business. And so standard science says, oh, the earth had a wobble. The snow built up on one side, and eventually Siberia wandered up from its more tropical region, and then the mastodons died off. Well, no, this was boom. The earth shifted about 30 degrees, the cold set in, and it happened like whammo. And this is the Moses event. Remember that the Noah event, as far as we know, that there was no pole shift with the Noah event. We simply were 40 days and 40 nights approximately going through the tail of a comet, where we had, this was a big comet, so you had inundated water, which was just tremendous water. And now let's go back to the fact that Mars just recently had its atmosphere expanded with the passage of comet sighting spring, a very, very little comet. So that's what happened to Earth. Earth had a very grave change in its atmosphere during the Moses event. We had oil that came in. The ancients talk about the fire in Naphtha that came in from the sky, the burning oil. The Moses event, they talk about the pillar of fire. And in the previews to the current Exodus movie, they show that. They show the pillar of fire. It's part of the story. You can't talk about the Moses event without the pillar of fire. What was the pillar of fire? It's the electrical connection to the comet that was passing by. And so you had mountain ranges develop. Not all the mountain ranges of the world developed at that time. Many had developed prior to that. So at any rate, that was the Moses event. But the big change came, and it's my belief that the mastodons died off during the Moses event. We had the Olmecs and the early Mayans talk about that, the destruction of their cities and civilizations, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. That's in the Popol Vuh. That's what the Mayan that's at the core of the Mayan legends, all of the pyramids of the Mayan civilization, which flourished around 600 to 800 AD, still carried all of the mythological and religious overtones of Quetzalcoatl. The central character of their mythology was the comet that eventually became the planet Venus, but of course they don't talk about it as a comet, and modern archaeology completely denies it. That's something I've done a lot of work on, is Mayan archaeology. I've done this, I've surveyed the sites around the Yucatan and Honduras, and the result is that the grid of, say, Chichen Itza, one of the main deity cities of Quetzalcoatl, is off of the northeast-southwest grid by almost 13 degrees. If you take the northern direction of the city of Chichen Itza, it points towards a point in northern Ontario. So at any rate, the end result is that the Earth had a tremendous catastrophe. There was a pole shift during the Moses event, but as I say, as far as we can tell, it did not occur during the Noah event, which was thousands of years earlier. But in the Mayan mythology and in the Colburn and in all of the ancient texts that we can find, all the civilizations, the Chinese, the Indians, the Tibetans, they go back, they talk about the various, not one, but various Earth-wide disasters that occurred on Earth in the past 10,000 years. When Solon, the uncle of the great philosopher of Greece, was it Plato's uncle? I've forgotten. Solon went back to Egypt, the high priest, the secret priest cults of Egypt, and he said, hey, what's the history? What's the true history of the world? And they say, yeah, you guys are just a bunch of sheep herders that survived up in the mountains of Greece. Those were the people that eventually repopulated Greece. And they said to Solon, they said, you don't really know where you guys came from. But at the time of the great catastrophe, this was the Moses event, he said that the country of Atlantis and Greece were having a great war. And the Greeks began to win the war, but it was about that time when Atlantis fell. And so they related the country, or the empire, you might say, of Atlantis with the Moses event, which is very interesting, because prior to that we really didn't have a notion. And there was a physicist in South America who did very great work. I talk about this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, that Atlantis has been found. The U.S. Navy has been doing work there. It's in the South China Sea. In that long, big plain area, the South China Sea is very shallow, and it still has a lot of floating bogs of grass, the type of grass that surrounded the entrance to the continent of Atlantis. And so Atlantis went under the ocean in a night, basically, is the story. And when the people eventually went back to find it, all they could find were the grass fields which surrounded it. The entrance to Atlantis, the great pillars of Hercules, that was the entrance to Atlantis, was Krakatoa and its sister volcano in off of Sumatra. That was the entrance of Atlantis. But you'll never ever hear that. All of the phony stories that come out in the news today about where Atlantis was, here or there, etc. Egypt was a small colony of Atlantis, but it was not Atlantis, the main continent. And the Greeks talk about it being off beyond the pillars of Hercules, and somehow it got to be interpreted as the Rock of Gibraltar. Well, no, the pillars of Hercules were the plumes of smoke coming out of Krakatoa and its sister volcano. And you could see those hundreds of miles off, and the glowing in the atmosphere from those pillars of smoke coming out of the volcanoes. You could see that from hundreds of miles away, and that guided the mariners in so they could enter into the South China Sea, what is currently the South China Sea. into the continent of Atlantis. So at any rate, back to the Great Flood. So thousands of years prior to the Moses event was the Great Flood, where the Earth passed through the comet tail, and we don't know what that comet was. We don't have any information. Could it have been Hale-Bopp? That's one of the possibilities, because actually Earth came very close to passing through the tail of Hale-Bopp, and if we would have passed through the tail of Hale-Bopp, you can calculate this, you don't have to depend on me, the transit time of the tail of Hale-Bopp would have been about a month. And so very likely that could have been the comet that we went through the tail during the NOAA event. And remember, it's interesting that Father Malachi Martin, a guy who used to be on the old Art Bell show a lot, and of course was murdered, one of his statements was that after Hale-Bopp was discovered, the Vatican quick built some comet observatories. The first one was down in Arizona. I know about that because I knew some of the astronomers from the University of Minnesota who manned that facility. But their role was to determine if Hale-Bopp was wormwood. That was what the Vatican wanted to know. So what does the Vatican have to do with trying to determine what comets were part of ancient disaster history? And why aren't they informing the public, and why aren't they instrumental in educating the public about this? Why is it secret knowledge? Why is the Vatican, the wealth that came into the Vatican in the Middle Ages and the Rothschild banking empire guarding the wealth of the Vatican? These are some major questions that the people have to answer and understand how the world spins today. The Rothschild banking system controls the federal government, the Federal Reserve of the United States, which controls the federal government of the United States. The CIA is the police force of that monetary system that comes from the Rothschilds. You know, you got to understand these connections to understand what's going on in the world today. They also control NASA and the science that is done through government agencies in the United States. And so why all the misinformation about comets, or the origin of Earth, or the origin of man, or these ancient disasters, when it's fully well known that the Vatican is on top of all of this, is manning large observatories down in South America, now at the South Pole, manned with professional astronomers looking for wormwood, Nibiru, Planet X. And NASA has studies showing that there are thousands of these objects. They stopped announcing them after about the 40th one had been observed. They have automated search results, and the public is not privy to any of this information. What they pawn off on the public, you know, that's who you depend on for your information. I mean, Discover Magazine and all these glossy magazines, the Discovery Channel, Discovery Magazine, the National Geographic, all of these being mouthpieces for the Tier 2 information, Tier 2 fairy tale science that comes out of NASA. I'll see you next week. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.